Welcome to The Carlina Show, where ordinary people share their hero's journey. I'm your host, Carlina Angwin, and this is episode 31 of the podcast. Today on the show, we have Juanita Ramsey Jevney. Juanita is the widow of a Vietnam veteran who used the death with dignity option to end his battle with Agent Orange-induced prostate cancer. You can visit the Carlina Show website at carlina.net to learn more about Juanita and link to the show notes. From there, you can find past episodes, connect on social media, and sign up for the mailing list. Thank you, Stephen Lorca, for video editing and production. And now I bring you Juanita Ramsey Jevney. Did you meet your husband before or after he served in Vietnam?
It was long after. He went to Vietnam in 69 and I was 11. And so I met him when he was 44 and he was just, he was rising from the bottom of his PTSD. Mm-hmm. He wasn't in the very worst depths of it. He had, we met... I was a teacher at a Head Start program, which is a preschool program, federal preschool program for low-income families. And he had gotten his master's in teaching, and there weren't any regular teaching jobs at the public school, mm-hmm. but he wanted the experience, so he took a job teaching at Head Start.
What year was that you met him?
The fall of 1986.
1986. Okay, so mm-hmm. he had been back from Vietnam for how many years?
Oh, gosh, 69 to 86. We could do that math.
Yeah.
What is that?
I'll let the listeners do that math.
18 years.
18 years after. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you said that he was just coming out of the effects of PTSD?
Well, he was starting to recognize he had it. And
okay.
So he right after Vietnam, he got a job. When he got done... Well, maybe we should back up.
Okay.
So he was a volunteer, and he volunteered. He wanted to be a Marine, and he volunteered for officer candidate school. And so he was a platoon commander. Mm-hmm. He went over as a platoon commander okay. in the Marines. Mm-hmm. And the reason he volunteered, as he put it, because he thought about this and talked about this a lot, he could have stayed in college and gotten avoided the draft, but he felt he really trusted our government at that time. He really believed everything they were saying. And his mom saved every letter he ever wrote to her. Mm-hmm. And there were letters that I've used in the book about him, you know, saying, if I can just get the men in my platoon to understand that we, you know, the reason we're there is to win the hearts and minds of the people. And he really believed it. Mm-hmm. He really believed we were over there for a noble reason, and he wanted to support that. Mm-hmm. The first day he landed in Vietnam, his best friend who had signed up with him but had gone over earlier was already dead. He found out he was dead. He looked around and he said, oh, you know, in his letters, he said, I was so wrong. This is not anything about what they've said, that the reason we're here. Mm-hmm. And what have I done? And why was I so naive? Mm-hmm. And he used to berate himself that he had one of the best educations our country could provide, and why had he never been taught how to think for himself? Mm-hmm. And why had he never thought for himself? He was just an athlete. It was all, you know, patriotism, mm-hmm. you know, be a team member, be a team player. And he applied that. So then his goal became to keep his men alive, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. to do what they had to do. But his main responsibility and the only way to be a good platoon commander in that situation was to do all he could to keep his men alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Did he start talking to you about his time
first
in Vietnam?
Date.
Your first date, really?
Yeah. Our first date. I mean, he was very open that he'd been there by the time I met him. And I was actually kind of flattered by that, because like all of us, you know, that were young and were watching it on TV, and then the vets were coming back, and then you'd hear how hard it was for them to talk about it. So our first date, we meet at a movie theater, And he, somebody had told us that the movie Raising Arizona was like funny or something. And it wasn't for us because, you know, we were preschool teachers. So this little kid, it wasn't good. And then the explosion happened where the guy on the motorcycle gets blown up or something. Uh-huh. And there's an explosion. And then there's a close up of a boot, a high top lace up. Pretty much looks like a combat boot on the pavement. Mm-hmm. And Bill started shaking and he had to leave. He just panicked and he said, I have to get out of here. And so we had to leave the theater. Mm-hmm. So there we are in the theater and he tells me about probably one of the worst things that happened was when, because of a mistake, friendly fire, one of US plane bombed the village that he and his platoon were just checking, and mm-hmm. they hadn't called in. Nobody had called in any fire, and he had left men in the center of the village and was just going out to check the perimeter. And so I think 7 of his men got killed, plus all the Vietnamese women and children.
Oh, wow.
And what he found as he was going around to pick up the pieces was boots.
Oh.
With the bodies pretty much turned to jelly inside the boot.
So he told you this on your first date?
Yeah, and then he left to go talk to a group had just formed in our little town, and it was a group of vets, and it was really new at the time. They were barely using the term PTSD, but he had a counselor in that group, another Vietnam vet, and so he just said, I'm sorry, I have to go, I gotta call my counselor, I gotta get out of here. Mm-hmm. So I drove myself home.
And this was in what state was this?
Home. Pardon me?
What state was this?
This was Washington State.
This was Washington.
Up on the Olympic Peninsula.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And so had he talked about his experience in Vietnam with anyone before, or did he just open up to you?
Well, that group he was, you know, he did the classic thing. He came home, he didn't, you know, he got out, he didn't really talk about it. He decided after everything he'd went through that he just wanted to have fun. So he skied, and he became a ski instructor and a hockey coach in France for like 7 years. Mm-hmm. And then it started catching up with him. So he didn't really talk about it much. Mm-hmm. But then once he started the therapy and it was a group of guys talking, then they all started realizing, oh, we need to talk about this. And then he would talk he was just beginning to talk about it then. And then during our marriage, he would go talk to people's classes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He would do presentations at classes. He would talk at veterans events. He was open about it after that because he felt like it was really important to be open about it.
Right, right. Okay, and then how soon after were you married after that date?
Well, that was in November of 2016, and we were married in May, not 2016, 1986, and we were married May 7th,
1988.
Yeah, so it was a year. We got engaged. That was like, I don't remember exactly, I think in the fall.
Uh-huh.
No, that was in January. We got engaged in May, mm-hmm. but we stayed engaged for a year just because he was going through so much therapy and stuff
mm-hmm.
that we just had I just was like, you know, I think we might need to take some time here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
okay.
We were engaged for a year.
Okay. And you have a son?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when was he born?
92.
92. Okay.
Yeah, he's a little Agent Orange story because we didn't know it at the time, but one of the side effects of Agent Orange is it kills sperm and reduces fertility. So it took us 4 years to get pregnant, and then we only had him. There was only one pregnancy.
So when did the effects of Agent Orange start?
Well, apparently they were there even then with the infertility. There's been more research done, infertility and some other things. But when we knew the first lump of what turned out to be cancer showed up when our son was 2.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And he, and then he got diagnosed officially. It was, the first lump was pretty small. They weren't sure what it was. And, it was really small, but then the cancer actually was diagnosed right after our son turned six. He turned six in October, and the cancer was diagnosed in January.
So could you tell me what is Agent Orange?
It was the defoliant that they were spraying. The planes would come and spray all over Vietnam because Vietnam was such a thick jungle that it made the fighting really, really hard. Mm-hmm. So Agent Orange was a type of defoliant, and the planes would just fly low and just blanket the country with it.
And these were U.S. planes?
U.S. planes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
And it just, you know, the leaves would just fall off the jungle. It was called Agent Orange because it left an orange powder all over everybody and everything.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. And so that's when he noticed the first signs of Agent Orange was when he got...
Was the cancer.
That's when he realized. Yeah. Okay.
Well, and you know, it eventually, the connection became certain enough, like... not immediately when he first got the cancer did they say Agent Orange related prostate cancer. He just had prostate cancer. Uh-huh. But then within a couple years, the VA came out and said, if you served in Vietnam and you were in these areas at these times, these years, you were exposed to Agent Orange, and we do consider if you have prostate cancer, it is directly related to Agent Orange.
Okay. Okay. All right.
So, like, his death certificate says prostate cancer related to Agent Orange due to service in Vietnam.
Okay. So let's. I know this is kind of out of chronological
it's okay.
order.
Jump anywhere.
But let's jump back to. Tell me a little bit about like who you are before you met your husband. Where are you from, and what were some of the things that influenced your life?
Oh, okay. Well, I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1958, right when the whole Little Rock Central High School, you know, the integration of Central High School and the governor calling out the National Guard and that whole mess. Mm-hmm. And, but then when I was five, we moved up to Joplin, Missouri, and my dad had cancer at the time. It was lymphatic cancer. Mm-hmm. So he died, we moved up in April, and he died in August. He was 39, and my mom was suffering from, some kind of, we didn't know what it was at the time, but some kind of, like, hallucinations and psychosis, and it was... you know, so there were four little kids and this mom left with them and undiagnosed and no relatives or no family around. And because of her psychosis, I think there any relative that might have reached out to help, although they were really far away, I think she probably, you know, if you've ever dealt with anybody with mental illness, they're pretty good at scaring people away. So it was a pretty isolated and challenging childhood. In a lot of ways, but Joplin was my dad got us into a safe neighborhood in a good school district, and amazingly, somehow he managed to get a mortgage so that we weren't in a rental where a landlord would have come and seen my mom and kicked us out. Mm-hmm. So we, for my part of our childhood, I got to spend, that's so funny, I got to spend, but it's true. I got to go to the same school district and all that. My brother's 6 years older than me, and he changed schools a million times before we got to Joplin. So I think it made a big difference that we got to be stable. Mm-hmm. So even though mom was really, truly crazy, that was at home. But because we lived in the same neighborhood, I could get a job, I could go to school, I could be successful outside of the home. Mm-hmm. And so... that made a big difference. But I remember the Vietnam War. My brother had a draft number, and he was quite a bit younger than my husband. But so the war was winding down, but it was still a big influence. You know, watching all the older brothers in the neighborhood, and you know, everybody worried about the draft and those numbers. And I also remember watching our little bitty black and white TV. And the reports about the soldiers coming home and how different it was coming home one at a time and being isolated. And, you know, I really grew up under the shadow of that war, that and Watergate. And I remember my friend up the street came down the street one day with one of those MIA POW bracelets. Mm-hmm. You might be too young, but it was a big deal to wear one of those. And mm-hmm. that meant you were, I don't know if you had if they got a particular prisoner and a name or whatever, but she had, her family had given her some money and she'd paid some money to help them somehow. And I didn't have any money to do that, but I remember looking at it and I remember looking at the television and thinking, my heart just felt so sad for those young men coming back. Mm-hmm. And I was only 10 or 11, but I remember thinking, you know, I really want to help one of those soldiers. And mm-hmm. it was years later after I'd met Bill, and I think it was either during our engagement or after our marriage, I went, oh my gosh, I remembered seeing that bracelet and going, oh my goodness. I did.
Wow.
I did. I just didn't know it was going to be so much later. Mm-hmm. So, yep. So we survived that rather challenging childhood, to put it mildly, but that's a whole nother story. And I don't want to get the podcast, you know,
no, that's okay.
Too diverted.
Yeah.
And then I ended up going to college. Mm-hmm. Because, so one thing that's interesting is both my mom and dad were also Marines, and they were Marines in World War II.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And my mom, there were only 1,000 Marines, female Marines, and she was one of them. Wow. So before her mental illness kicked in, she was a pretty kick-ass lady.
Wow.
She went, you know, she got herself, she had some college, she went off to Camp Pendleton in California and San Diego and was a Marine and served through the war, and that's where she met my dad.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. So do you think the war influenced
her
mental health and brought out that mental illness?
You know, the depression, the war, and then especially post-war, because my dad was from Mississippi. They moved back from Mississippi. She was a Yankee. You know, the war mixed up, really scrambled.
Uh-huh.
You know, the country was much more rural, much uh-huh. more isolated, much more differences. And here this independent Yankee woman from Indiana marries this Mississippi man. They can't find any jobs, so they go back to Mississippi. And this is the worst of the Jim Crow and all that. And she just... Mm-hmm. She was isolated, shocked, and was supposed to be that, you know, ideal 50s housewife.
Right. Okay.
I think it had a lot to do with, you know, there was, uh-huh. I think, you know,
right.
the tipping, you know, what tips somebody over, mm-hmm. and stress is often mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. stress, isolation. And she was always, she, you know, when they learned about the concentration camps and the horrors of she knew a lot of young men that went out to, the war with the Japanese, you know, out in the islands. And she really paid attention to all the horror stories from out there, and it haunted her. So yeah, I think she had her own,
her
own version of war trauma.
So when did you first hear about Death with Dignity?
Yeah, so that happened. I actually voted for it when Washington State put it on the ballot. And if I was looking at my notes, I could tell you when that was. I think it was 2008, maybe. Mm-hmm. And as happens in most of the states, the legislature rarely passes it, and it usually becomes a citizen initiative, although some state did just the legislature. Oh, anyway, I can't remember. I just found out what state it was. It might have been Maine. I don't remember. Anyway, so it was a citizen initiative.
Uh-huh.
And by then, Bill's mom and dad had moved out to Washington, and I remember his mom and Bill and I all voted for it,
uh-huh.
in favor of it. But I didn't really pay that much attention to it. At that time, Oregon was the only state that had it, and like most people, I was calling it assisted suicide, and which we can get into in a minute,
mm-hmm.
why it's not the best terminology for it. But I just remember thinking... gosh, it would be nice if you were really, really sick to have that option. So
uh-huh.
I voted for it.
So you were thinking before, so you had, there's a transformation somewhere where you went from thinking of it as assisted suicide to something
different.
That's
what everybody called it. It wasn't until Bill's mom used it that I understood there was other terminology for it.
Okay.
But anyway, I'll get into that. So, you know, we voted for it, and none of us really, I didn't connect it with Bill's cancer. He went in and out of remission so many times. He was very tough. He had his cancer for 23 years. And most of that time, he was, you wouldn't have known he had cancer if you met him. He was athletic and strong and fit and alert. And I mean, there was, there were side effects, but they were pretty personal and private. They mm-hmm. mainly have to do with libido and mm-hmm. the lack thereof. Because mm-hmm. As the cancer gets worse, and this is just prostate cancer, this isn't necessarily Agent Orange, but one of the treatments for prostate cancer, later stage prostate cancer, is they take a hormone suppression drug, which is the goal is to strip the man's body of testosterone. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very... It's hard on any man, but it was very hard on Bill. You know, they lose their body hair, they lose their muscle mass. He was having hot flashes, breasts swell up like he's a woman in menopause. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, so when we voted for Death with Dignity in 2008, Bill didn't die till 2017. So he was 9 years away, mm-hmm. and was pretty healthy. Prostate cancer tends to be somewhat what you'd call mild mm-hmm. for a long time, and then, as one doctor told us, and then it's like they in the end stages, it's like they fall off the cliff, and it's just the end stage is fast and vicious and horrible. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. up until that, it's pretty slow growing. They have pretty good treatments, so men can live a pretty long time with it. Mm-hmm. And live a fairly normal life, but it does do weird things to the male psyche. And mm-hmm. and like he cried, boy, after that testosterone was gone. Mm-hmm. The staff meetings got funny. People, he'd go, "Is it hot in here?" and then somebody would tell him something sad, and he would just be crying and crying. And he couldn't help it.
yeah. So you voted for it in 2008, and was your mother-in-law sick at that point?
No. Okay. She was a very stoic person, and she didn't know she had cancer until it was late stage, totally pervasive, metastatic. Mm. And she qualified. Like, we got the phone call that she'd been having like hip pain and she'd been losing weight, but she was just so together and riding her bike every day that, plus she was in her 90s, and I think she'd already decided, even if she did get diagnosed, she wasn't going to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. So her regular doctor, it just didn't occur to anybody to test her for cancer. But then a regular doctor was on vacation, the pain was getting much, much worse. And that doctor said, "I'm going to run some tests." And he was the one who found out that she was riddled with cancer. And at this point, I couldn't even tell you what kind, because by then it had metastasized. So whatever kind of cancer it started as, mm-hmm. who knew? Mm-hmm. And that was in 2014. That was in March of 2014. And she knew about the Death with Dignity, but it didn't, you know, we weren't thinking of it until she got the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And then she remembered it. And Bill, we were on a trip. Bill flew home and helped her out with it. And her regular doctor was somebody who supported it. And it's a 2-week waiting period, and she waited 15 days.
So... what state were you all? What state
Washington.
Was she? She was in Washington.
This was still Washington, and so
it had passed in Washington.
Yeah, and okay. it had passed for quite a while. Okay. So she was so happy because she'd been depressed. She'd been saying, "I really feel like I'm done. I've lived a great life. I'm done, and I'm just failing, and I don't want to be a burden, and I don't want to lose control." So when she got the cancer, mm-hmm. it was like somebody won a lottery ticket. Mm-hmm. And although what I call it in the book is, she always said she lived in the departure lounge. She was in assisted living, and she called it the departure lounge. And even though it was the nicest place around, she hated it. She just hated feeling like useless. Uh-huh. And so she always said she lived in the departure lounge. So for her, cancer was her boarding pass to get out of there.
Okay, because she wouldn't have been able to do the Death with Dignity if she had not had cancer.
Well, or something like that. The qualifications, this might be a good time.
Okay.
In order to use Death with Dignity, one has to have a diagnosis. First, you have to be in sound mind, so you can't use it if you've got dementia or Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. or any of those memory issues, you have to have a diagnosis confirmed by two different doctors that you are in sound mind and that you have less than 6 months to live because you have a terminal illness with less than 6 months to live. Now, most of the time that's cancer. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of them, they, you know, you got them, but how long is it going to be? Like Parkinson's, mm-hmm. you know, it can drag on and drag on and drag on. Mm-hmm. And so she had the pervasive metastatic. It was way beyond, it was already spread so much. There was no hope of any treatment. Mm-hmm. She didn't want any treatment. And it was definitely, they mm-hmm. had no trouble saying it's less than 6 months. Mm-hmm. And her regular doctor had known her forever and knew she was of sound mind. But a second doctor came to her apartment and we left the room. And he did this very thorough interview with her. And she got all dressed up for it because she was going to pass that test. And he, when he left, he said, I don't usually say this, but your mother is an amazing woman. That was a privilege.
Wow.
She was so together. She knew exactly what she wanted. Uh-huh. And so every day with her, and it's interesting to look at this because she was very different than Bill. She was 92. She was done. Uh-huh. Bill was 72 and he wasn't finished with life and he really didn't want to quit. Uh-huh. So she took the first date possible and every day was a countdown. She, every time she woke up from a nap, what day is it? How much longer have I got? And she would call her date, which was April 22nd of 2014, her D-Day. And she would say, how long till D-Day? How long till D-Day? And when she talked to her friends, she would say, well, you know, I'm going to do this interesting thing out here. And so my D-Day's April 22nd. And she was just the happiest person.
Yeah, yeah. So you and Bill were there?
Oh yeah, we were there with her every day, and by then we had to spend the night there because she was in a lot of pain, and uh-huh. she was starting to fall, and you know we were just starting to need to help her go to the bathroom and take showers and get changed and stuff because she was getting weaker.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did Bill take it?
Oh, he was so happy that his mom had that option. It fit her personalities. Mm-hmm. She was a control freak. She loved the fact that she got to. Uh-huh. Death wasn't going to tell her what to do. I can't express that enough. Yeah. She was so happy. And our son was there too. Uh-huh. And then her other grandkids came. But no, we were all there and she was so open about it and calling everybody, telling them goodbye. And we had a series of parties for the last 2 weeks, a series of visitors coming over. And every time when they'd leave, she'd say, well, I won't be seeing you again, but I love you very much. And I'm really glad I knew you.
Wow. Wow. So what did Bill say after, like immediately after in the next couple of days, like how did he take it? What sort of things did he say to you?
Well, you know, he was pretty healthy. At that point, his cancer was in a pretty good remission. And we talked about how if he got to the point she was at with pain and stuff, that it's nice that we had that option. But it didn't seem to him that he would be dying anytime soon. Even though the irony is, in 2012, he'd had like an 8-year remission. In 2012, his cancer came back, and we were told he had 18 months to live. Mm-hmm. And so his mom was afraid that she was going to die before Bill. And actually, so was I, because I didn't want to have to take care of his mom. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if I could, because she was such a strong-willed person. So there was this real, like, just tension between Bill's lifespan and his mom's. And remember, she didn't even know she had cancer in 2012. Mm-hmm. But then there was a new treatment. It was called Provenge, and it was where they're doing it quite a bit now, but it was they took his T cells and they did something to him, took him out of his body, gave him some kind of a immune system boost, put him back in his body. Mm-hmm. And instead of 18 months, he lived for 5 more years.
Oh,
mm-hmm. So we got all this extra time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when she found out she had cancer, another reason she was so happy about it is she didn't want to outlive Bill. Mm. She really did not want to see him die first. Mm-hmm. And so because of that 18-month thing, and, you know, mm-hmm. by that time we were like, that was, so we were like 6 months over the prediction. But we were living with this hanging over our head all the time. Well, is it going to be a year? Is it going to be 2 years? Did it work? Did it not work? You know, mm-hmm. they don't tell you, oh, guess what? Now you have 3 years left. Mm-hmm. So we were always living with, from 2012 on, we were living with this, okay, how much time do we have left? Mm-hmm. So we definitely, having the death with dignity option was it was kind of like an ace, you know, an mm-hmm. ace in your pocket, or it was like, okay, well, if things get really horrible, mm-hmm. thank God we live in a state where we could use that.
And so what appealed to Bill about having that option for him?
Well, our doctor was not shy about telling us how incredibly painful and miserable the end of prostate cancer is. Mm-hmm. It's horrible. It can include, and I don't know if you want to jump to that, because the end stage of Bill's cancer was horrible. It did prove to be horrible. And I don't know if we want to go there now, but they had warned us that, you know, you go along all these years and the symptoms aren't too bad, but the end of it is just brutal. Mm-hmm. Its mm-hmm. systems are failing right and left. The pain is unbearable and barely controllable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's just swellings and it's awful. Mm-hmm. It's really, really brutal. Mm-hmm. And so knowing that he could just say, I've had enough, mm-hmm. and I'm going to end this now, mm-hmm. was really nice to know.
And at what point did he make that decision? Or at what point did he say, okay, I'm ready?
Well, you can't make it until the doctors agree that you have 6 months or less.
Okay.
So what started with Bill is in 2016... Yeah, 2016. He started one breast got really inflamed and the skin turned all red and scaly, and then, which he actually didn't show me, mm-hmm. And it was winter and he was wearing really baggy clothes, so I didn't know. But then it went into his lymph system, so his arm got hugely swollen, just so big, like as big as your thigh, and then. And that's why I saw his hand and said, Bill, what's going on? So that's when it started. And that was in April. And so for about the last year, maybe that was May. So about 11 months of increasing tumors spreading throughout his body, pain. You know, you hear all about the opioid crisis. At the end, Bill was wearing like 4 fentanyl patches, which are opioid, mm-hmm. and taking, you know, 3 opioid tablets like 4 times a day. And I mean, we just got to where he could barely stay ahead of the pain. Mm-hmm. And they tried some additional right at the end when, you know, with the lymph and everything. They tried additional chemotherapy and radiation, and they might have bought him an extra month. Mm-hmm. But so the tumors just started spreading everywhere, and the pain started getting just awful. Mm-hmm. And then the biggest thing was the paralysis. One of the tumors, they told us this would happen. He had a tumor in his spine, and it was pretty good size when they found it. And when it got big enough, it was going to paralyze him from that point down. And it was pretty high up in his back. So mm-hmm. the last 24 hours he had, and we already, so the thing is you get the doctor to agree, and oncologists are a stubborn lot. They don't like to give up. Mm-hmm. So here he was in really bad shape, and the oncologist just was like, well, we could do, you know, one more round of this or one more round of that. And finally, Bill had just so much pain this one weekend, and I was like, Bill, you have to tell him how much pain you're in. And it can't be me, because then it would look like I was influencing him. Mm-hmm. So we went into the appointment, and Bill finally let himself cry in front of the doctor, mm-hmm. and told him how much pain he was in, and just said, you know, that I don't think I have 6 more months. I don't think I can stand it. So he finally wrote the prescription. I think because of Bill's age, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't as easy as with his mom. But anyway, they wrote the prescription, and then we had it, and then finally I went and filled it on a Wednesday. Because Bill's leg gave out one day. And then he said, okay, you better get the drug. So you take it down to the pharmacy, they fill it. And a tip for anybody listening to this, don't, if you're the caregiver or the spouse, don't drive by yourself to pick up that prescription. That was the stupidest thing I did. When I was trying to drive myself home, which was a pretty long drive. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the shock of knowing you've just picked up the prescription that your spouse is going to use to end their life. It, you know, I could feel the blood kind of draining, and I'm in traffic and I'm going, oh, what was I thinking? I'm not sure I should be driving a car right now.
So you picked up the prescription, and then did you have to wait a certain amount of time before you could give it to him? Or once you had the prescription, then you could, or he could take it whenever he was ready?
You can take it whenever you're ready, but in, I don't know if this is every state, but in Washington, there's a group of volunteers, and they are not hospice, because hospice wants to not, they don't want people to you know, they need to have a clean line. Uh-huh. Like a hospice is not death with dignity. Mm-hmm. So there was a group of volunteers, and we had called them. And like with Bill's mom, they came over, they talked to her, they explained the process, they explained what was going to happen. And then we made a date with them. And then they came, this woman came, and she handed the pills to Bill's mom.
To Bill.
Now, in those days, no, this was Bill's mom.
Oh, Bill's mom, okay.
When Bill's mom did it, they keep refining the exact prescription. Mm-hmm. So we already knew that. So we had called them for Bill. And so we needed to make an appointment to have that volunteer there so that she would be there and not be the family member who's probably, you know, emotional and kind of falling apart, or at least emotional. So we had the prescription, but then, and the thing about the law is you don't ever have to use the prescription. Mm-hmm. You know, you have it, it's available, and there's some, if you go to the Compassion and Choices website, they keep all the data on how many people like actually get the prescription, but then choose not to use it. Mm-hmm. Some people just want it there, but it never gets so bad that they need to use it. They just die on their own without having ever taken it. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, it's a peace of mind to have it. But in Bill's case, I picked it up on Wednesday on, what was it? Friday, Thursday, he got to where he couldn't walk anymore. His legs wouldn't work. Thursday afternoon. Thursday evening, he realized he really had to pee, but he couldn't. And I had to call hospice, and the paralysis had started, and he couldn't pee. Mm. But when they put the catheter in, he couldn't feel it, but the urine came out and was just huge relief. Mm. And that was the night we were like, so that was, then it became Friday. And that's when we were like, so Bill, he goes, well, what happens now? Because, you know, I can't move my legs. And I said, well, here's what I know. We're going to have to turn you. We're going to have to get nursing help. We're going to have to watch for bed sores. You're going to have to keep this catheter in. Somebody's going to have to manually evacuate your bowels. You know, on and on it went, because the hospice nurse had told me all this, that when the paralysis went that far. And he said, well, if that's how it's going to be, if I can't move anymore, then I'm done. And plus, he was still having all this pain and swelling and everything. So he decided on Friday that he would like to do it on Saturday, and I called the volunteer, and she said she could be there Saturday. Mm-hmm. And then we were in a race. The thing about the drug is you have to be able to, the patient, the dying person, has to be able to self-administer, which is why that whole assisted suicide isn't really accurate. We don't have a good word for it. It's not suicide the way suicide usually is. Suicide, for most people, the way we think of it is it's out of despair. Mm-hmm. It's done alone. It's a big dark secret. And you don't have a group of people standing around helping, you know, like being there with you, and you're not talking about it. Mm-hmm. So using death with dignity, it's a open decision. It's legal. You get you know, you have loved ones there. You usually are telling everybody, and it brings people close together. and it heals families, and it makes death, you know, something that everybody can be present to, as opposed to this isolated, shameful act that you go hide in a corner to do. Mm-hmm. So that's why the whole assisted suicide isn't really a very good term for it at all. Mm-hmm. It's more like, I would say, it's called embracing your death, mm-hmm. is what I would use. Mm-hmm. But anyway, now we're in a race against the paralysis because it's moving pretty quickly. So Friday night, he can't move at all anymore. Saturday, the volunteer comes, and some relatives had come. And so we're all gathered around, and Bill could still use everything basically from his diaphragm up. And so I kept going in and out of the room to see how he was. He was, you know, saying goodbye to all of us. But then I went in the room, and he was on the phone, and he looks up at me, and he called every surviving member of his platoon to say goodbye.
Wow.
So I was thinking, it didn't occur to me till I was working on the book, that our first date began with the story of these men, these young men getting killed.
Yeah.
And our last hours ended with him, still the platoon commander, calling his remaining,
wow,
you know, members and telling them, you know, I'm going to be dying in about an hour, and I, you know, I wanted to say goodbye to you.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
Wow.
And in between then, he had made on Wednesday when he sent me, you know, when he decided it was time to get the drug, we sat together and he made a list of the people that lived in our town that he wanted to call and invite to come over so he could say goodbye. Mm-hmm. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, he spent saying goodbye to people. Mm-hmm. Some of them in person, and then the ones he couldn't reach in person by phone.
Wow.
Yeah. But he had his list, and he was going through his list of all the guys he could reach, and if he couldn't reach him, he left him a message.
Yeah, yeah. So describe the moment that he took the pills.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had gone through it with his mom, so we were ready. And what technically happens is, like, for his mom, in those days, the medicine came in capsules. So the volunteer had to empty out all these capsules and make this pile of powder, stir it up in this drink, tasted horrible. And then his mom had to chug it down, and then you immediately hand him some, like, vodka or rum or something strong because it helps mm-hmm. accelerate the thing. By the time 2 years, 3 years later, 3 years later, when Bill was doing it, they had changed the prescription somewhat. It already came powdered, thank goodness. And so the volunteer was in the other room. She mixed it up. Oh, the first thing that happens is they give him an anti-nausea pill. And when you take the anti-nausea pill, you have 45 minutes because you have to wait that long for it to take effect. So that's kind of like, okay. You know, everyone says, what would it be like if we knew exactly when we were going to die? Well, I can tell you, you've got in 45 minutes, you're going to take this other drink and you're going to go into a coma. So in those 45 minutes, with his mom, we sat around in a circle and she recited a poem and everybody sang some songs and all this stuff. And with Bill, he took his anti-nausea drug and two of his cousins and a good friend from college, and William and I were there. And we just went around the circle, said, we love you, hugged him, you know, all that. And then she brought in the drink. Now with his mom, as soon as she drank the drink, it was almost immediate. She just boom, and her head was down. And then it took about 2 hours of her slow being in the coma and slowly dying. With Bill, they changed the drug a little bit. He had more like about 2.5 minutes of calmness before. And so, he spent the time with William and I with our arms wrapped around him and just staring at each other and saying, you know, I love you. And then he just dropped into a very peaceful sleep. And we put the bed back. And he only took 45 minutes to go.
Mm-hmm.
By the time he took it, the paralysis had crept up a little higher. His arms moved, and he could still swallow.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sat And I have been trained as an EMT, and I know that when you're trying to keep somebody from dying, you want to keep touching them and you want to keep talking to them. But when you're trying to let somebody die and help somebody die, I think it's important not to touch him and not to talk to him. Mm-hmm. And so we just, William sat on one side and I was on the other, and a friend of ours was sitting at the foot of the bed. Mm-hmm. And his cousins didn't really want to watch him actually die, and his friends, so they were out in the living room. Mm-hmm. And we just sat there and waited, and then I just felt his breathing started slowing right away. And then all this, I felt this moment where I felt like his energy had just sank into the ground. Mm. And Bill had always said that he always thought when he died, he was just going to return to the earth because he loved the earth so much. And then right after there was that sinking feeling, I felt like somebody had just blown a dandelion seed head, like, because some little bit just went poof. Mm-hmm. And that little bit went up. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, he just died. And so I waited a minute and we checked, and sure enough, he had. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you call hospice. They come back to certify that he's dead and sign that, yes, he did die. And then you call the mortuary, mm-hmm. when you're ready, or, you know, to come get the body. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it was very peaceful. And he had so many horrible pain breakthroughs where he was just screaming. Mm-hmm. We'd given him everything we had, and mm-hmm. that it was such a relief. Mm-hmm. You know, it was such a relief that he didn't have to keep going through that. So many times.
So this was an interesting time for you, professionally as well, because you were in grad school finishing up a manuscript about your mother-in-law.
Using death with dignity.
And then you experienced this with your husband.
Yeah, and one of his best friends had gotten cancer later, was a little bit younger than Bill. He used the death with dignity in November.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so three.
And then
three
Bill people. Used it in April. And at one point, Bill and I had this strange conversation where he said, the morning after we found out Denny had died, and he said, well, knowing what Denny's done really helps me. And I was like, because I thought, oh, I thought you had already, you know, you were already okay with it because of your mom. Mm-hmm. But Denny had felt okay about it because of what we told him about Bill's mom.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, it was like this spiral. You know, there'd been Bill's mom, and Denny had been very aware of it because he'd known her and everything and heard how good it was. And then when it was his turn, mm-hmm. it had been a really good option for him. And then maybe it was that Denny was more Bill's age, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you one thing I really learned, no matter what you think by watching other people, until it's your own death mm-hmm. and your own illness, it's kind of like having, you know, you just, like so much in life, until you go through it yourself, you don't really know who you're going to be in that time.
Right.
You know, until for years, Bill said he didn't want to be the fact that he did those last chemo and radiation treatments was a complete surprise, because he had always said he didn't want to prolong it, mm-hmm. you know. And then when it actually came to it, he really, really loved life. So that's one thing that people will say is that, you know, that, oh, life is so important, I would never use that. And I'm thinking, well, you might be surprised, because Bill really didn't want to die. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he really fought to live, but mm-hmm. it was a really good option when it got to the point where, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, where his definition, is that how you say that word?
Definition?
Of living, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. it wasn't that, you know,
yeah.
It wasn't screaming in pain and being on a morphine drip. Mm-hmm. And having to have somebody turn him and wash his bed sores. That was when he was like finally done. But he pushed it. It wasn't like his mom, like I said earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, her life was full and complete.
Yeah.
And he wanted to stay as long as he could.
So how many states have passed
now,
the law? Yeah,
let me see. So it was Oregon, California, Washington, Montana, Colorado passed it. Again, a citizen initiative. Colorado, Massachusetts, Hawaii, District of Columbia. I think we're up to 9 or 10.
9 or 10 states. Okay.
Yeah, 9 or 10 right now. There's okay. one that just passed it. Well, it's on the governor's desk. Now, at the same time, there are, like, California's got taken to court to try to get it overturned because the people for whom life is sacred find it, you know, think it's horrible. Mm-hmm. And it's not simple.
So do people move to states so that they can be in a state that has passed a law? The death of dignity law?
I've only heard of one. There's a great website called Compassion and Choices, and they are the group of people that support, like if a group in a state wants to get an initiative going, mm-hmm. they will help with all the information. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have only heard of that like once. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure if that's what happened. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's this big flood of people.
Yeah.
It's not like when pot gets legalized.
Yeah. Okay. And you actually have to live in the state. So it's not like you can live in a bordering state and then, no. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you have to have a physician. Mm-hmm. You have to have a relationship with a physician. Mm-hmm. You have to be a patient of somebody. And one of the things about the law is any physician has the right to say, no, this does not fit my moral values and I don't want to do this. So nobody's forced to do it. Mm-hmm. And neither is any pharmacy. The pharmacy has to be willing and believe in it. And the physicians have to believe in mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. So there's no coercion or anything. Mm-hmm. Now, it's good. It's a good conversation to have if somebody thinks, you know, that they might want to have it someday. It might be an interesting conversation. Like, we were actually living in Colorado because Bill wanted to ski. So his last year, he skied 90 days mm-hmm. in Colorado. And then the cancer exploded everywhere. And we moved back to Washington. And that next winter was, you know, the winter he died. But mm-hmm. his penultimate winter, he was very active and very happy. Mm-hmm. And so he really did, you know, just push it right up to the end. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's a good conversation to have mm-hmm. just, you know, even out of curiosity.
Yeah.
I'm a great believer in saying, hey, you know, hey, my doctor, you know, what do you believe about this? So when his symptoms came up in Colorado and we had kept our house in Washington, we knew we'd move there. This was just a temporary thing. We knew we were going to go back if things got worse. I called our family doctor and just said, hey, you know, Bill's gotten a lot worse. It's here, 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 and here. Do you support this? And he said, yeah, I would support Bill in that. Mm-hmm. He didn't end up being the primary doctor. He ended up being the secondary doctor. Mm-hmm. The oncologist became the primary one. But yeah. He had to have a secondary doctor who would, you know, mm-hmm. interview Bill and mm-hmm. say, yeah, he's terminal. And he's of sound mind. Mm-hmm.
Have you had anybody since then, have you had anybody that like criticized you or criticized his decision or questioned you or anything like that?
You know, no. The short answer is no. And I've done quite a few talks because uh-huh. so many people, my most interesting talk was with... because it had just passed in Colorado, and I live in Colorado now, was with the county coroner who had never met anybody who had gone through it. And, you know, since it's new in Colorado, he said, well, gosh, what was it like? Because mm-hmm. I think I should know.
Yeah.
I was like, well, who are you? And he said, well, I'm so-and-so, but I'm the coroner. And I said, oh, I never had a conversation with the coroner before.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, what would you like to know? But anyway. You know, and we had family members, like for people who are Catholics, ending your life is a mortal sin. And so we had a very, very close family member who loved both Bill's mom and Bill deeply, really close to him. And for her, she was amazing. She was so good. She'd come visit she'd say goodbye. She didn't want to be there when they died. And she pretty much didn't want to hear about it because it was so heartbreaking to her because of her belief system. But she fully honored their right to make their choice. Mm-hmm. And boy, I tell you, it just made me admire her all the more.
Yeah.
Because I looked it up. I was like, well, what's mortal sin? I didn't even know because I'm not Catholic. And I was like, wow. If you really believe this was a mortal sin, you know, if that was your belief system, it would be heartbreaking to have somebody you love do it.
Right, right. Are you religious?
Not that way. Not.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't have a.
Okay.
I didn't believe it was a mortal sin.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people that you would say is more spiritual than.
Uh-huh.
I don't have a set religion. I do go to a church, but I don't have a strong set religion that would have an opinion about that either way.
Right, right. I posted on Facebook that I was going to talk to you about Death with Dignity and asked if people had any questions. And I was really surprised at how many questions people had about this. And then just also in conversation with people. So I'm looking at their questions now.
You know, one question they might not have thought of asking, that whether a person uses death with dignity or whether they don't, because there's a lot of reasons why they can't, like if they don't meet the qualifications or they have a belief against it.
Uh-huh.
What the main thing that anybody can have access to is to be open about facing death. That was what... my mom did not use death with dignity, but we came to a point where we could say, Mom, do you know what's happening? And she said, yes. And we said, what's happening? And she said, I'm dying. And the fact that we spent the last week of her life openly saying, yes, you're dying, Mom. And it was hard. It was a hard process for her. And she sometimes would say, I'm so tired. This is so hard. And we would say to her, yes, Mom, you are doing such a good job. Dying is hard work. You're letting go of your body, and that takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength, and you're doing such a good job. Mm-hmm. And she would take a breath, and she would say, oh, that's right. I'm dying, aren't I? And we'd say, yeah. And you know, you're doing such a good job, and it's okay to go. So the most important piece of this was facing death openly and letting the person who's dying know that you know they're dying, and making sure everybody around them, like when people would come visit my mom or call her to say goodbye, you know, I would say, make sure she knows that you know this is it. And so my son said, Grandma, I'm going back to college and I won't be seeing you again. Hmm. And she said, I know, William, have a good life.
Wow.
And so that part, aside from the death with dignity, I mean, my mother-in-law was the extreme, you know, like celebratory, you know, and really facing it strongly. And then Bill, Bill inviting everybody over and calling his platoon members. In every case, it was such a gift. And people were sometimes shocked. Like some people would say, well, this isn't the last time. I'll be seeing you again. And I'd just look at them and say, no, you won't. Mm-hmm. You know, you really won't. Because some people it was just too much for them. But most people were so grateful to be able to just say, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and thank you for sharing your life with me. And I mean, it was that part anybody can do. If we have the courage.
Right.
You know, so whether or not somebody qualifies or uses the death with dignity or not, letting death into the room to sit there with us and to reap the gift that death has for us, which is just for once be fully present.
Right.
Say what you got to say. Say what you need to say. You know, say that love. And that's the miracle of it.
Yeah.
And then the gift is that a person can choose if they qualify, and if they're in a state that lets them, they can choose to say, I've had enough. And you know, taking that drug is like just opening your arms to death and saying, I'm ready, let's go.
Yeah, yeah.
And not kicking and screaming, but just like, you know what, it's okay. This body has served me well, and it's tired, and it's done its best, and I'm going to let this body go.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the part that I just like... I hope people get from this.
Right, right. So what's next for you?
Oh,
Where are you in the? Go ahead.
did you have questions? You were looking at the questions that I interrupted you. Are there some questions we missed?
Let's see. Well, one person wanted to know, how did the two of you deal with the way vets were treated when they returned home?
Right. So I wasn't there when Bill came home, but and by the time we got together, the people were kind of recognizing. But I can tell you the impact it had on Bill, which was he, when 9/11 happened, we were married, and when war was declared, he was had a total meltdown and just said, "I can't do this again. We're doing it again." He didn't believe in the weapons of mass destruction existed. He said that, they're lying again, it's happening again. And he was like, he honestly, I have never seen him so distraught. He said, "Starting again, and there's more young men going to be killed, and there's more families are going to fall apart." And he was like trying to figure out if, maybe we needed to move to Canada. It was a horrible, trigger flashback thing. But what he never recovered from was his distrust of the government. And so that made him really reluctant to use the VA. And we did have to because it got so expensive. But he just shook every time he had to. And
So as far as vets being treated poorly when they came home, did that have an effect on him?
he stayed in Europe.
Oh, okay.
He went to Europe and he lived in Europe for about 7 years.
Okay.
And Bill's personality was such, people always loved him, and people were just always, he just was one of these people that everybody just met and liked right away, and he didn't try. So he never really got any of that stuff too much. And he had been a Marine, he had volunteered and he'd been an officer, and he didn't really talk about that much. He mainly what he suffered from was his guilt that he had volunteered. That's what took him so long to get over, that he had not researched it carefully enough to really understand what the point of that war was, that it was, it was not to win the hearts and minds. It was just another power move, like happens. So that was, but I will tell you what I discovered was that we are just now starting to wake up to that a soldier does not serve alone, and that the impact of war never ends for the family. And that was the part that I felt, there were all these groups for the soldiers, but there weren't any groups for the spouses. Now there are now, but there weren't then. And there weren't, the recognition of what, the impact of this man or woman coming back from war, it's much more spoken about now, but when we got married, it was not. And so being, well, for one, and the other thing that was not recognized was that I was slow. I didn't realize it would have any impact on my marriage or my life. It had been so long ago. And I had two other friends who both ended up also marrying vets, and all of us took like 10 years before we realized, wait a minute, that war that happened back when I was 10, it's totally impacting my life, my marriage, my husband. And that was just so, if you marry somebody older than you, you don't realize that you married his war. And that is something that is not really spoken. You marry his dead, you marry his war, you marry his memory, you marry his living. And with very no support group, you don't get handed a packet. Oh, you're marrying a soldier. Here you go. We should be, male or female, if you're going to marry, especially somebody who's seen combat. If you're marrying a combat vet, you should be given a package when you first start dating them.
Well, maybe you could write that.
Maybe I should.
So someone else wants to know if you have any regrets about death with dignity.
Oh, let me think. I will think carefully about that. Not the using of it. My only, and it's not really regret, I wish it was available in all 50 states. I wish that more people knew about it and that, but in terms of having it available and using it, it was such, it has been for the two I've sat through and for the one that I was aware of, it was an absolute gift for everybody. And it changed everybody's family. It just made death this just, you know, it was just right there. And it was such a, in such a good way. You know, he was going to die. All of them were going to die. Mm-hmm. It was just a question of, were they going to, you know, really, really get miserable, or were they going to be able to, it's the name Death with Dignity is perfect. Because mm-hmm. right at the end, you know, they each claimed, I mean, our friend that died in between Bill's mom and Bill, I mean, he started bleeding out. He started just bleeding, and that's when he decided to use it. So, I mean, both he and Bill waited and waited and waited. Wow. So, no, I don't have any regrets about using it other than, and I, you know, I think right for right now, I think the requirements make a lot of sense. I don't know. Bill's father died of Alzheimer's, and the poor man was so confused. I don't think this would work at all. For somebody with memory issues or Alzheimer's or dementia, I totally get. I think it's a pretty darn well-written bill. Mm-hmm. I know there's a lot of conditions under which people do not have access to it. And for right now, I don't see how it could be any other way. Mm-hmm. Because the way it is right now, it's fairly, it's safeguarded, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So I do feel sorry for people who, I mean, those long, slow dementia cases just get heartbreaking. But this isn't the right thing to use for them.
Someone else asked, was writing a book about the experience cathartic or a struggle or both? And if the book could change something, what would that be?
Well, it was so cathartic that it's been sitting, the manuscript's finished and it's been sitting in a bottom drawer for a year because it was so cathartic that I had to step away in order to be able to now go through and actually see what I want to put out, but to be in the process of writing it and to just, but I'm a writer. So for me, just writing and writing and writing was very cathartic. Mm-hmm. And now comes the craft part, you know, the part where I need to say, okay, so the second part of the question is if it could change anything. And that's what I'm figuring out. What story do I want to tell for what impact? Because the first part, you know, when you've been married to a vet and then you've gone through 23 years of cancer and then even the last year when the symptoms were getting so bad, it's very normal for a caregiver to have a lot of, you just, you know, sometimes the dying person makes some really stupid choices and makes your life hell. And you know, you just need to allow yourself to be pissed about it because when you're in the midst of it, you don't. You can't, you know, you just got to keep rolling and rolling. But, oh, there were some days I was writing and if that page could have burst into flames, it would have. I was so mad. Oh, my God. And then he hid it from me. And I knew I needed to get it out, but I don't necessarily need to publish it in that torch blower. And now, because, oh, man. And, you know, one time, I mean, I had to write this out. One day he got triggered and I think, oh God, we'd been married 29 years and he started crying about his men that got blown up again. And for the only time in my entire marriage, I just looked at him and I said, you know, I think it's about time you just get over that because I can't stand here one more time and I'm leaving. It's about the worst thing you can say.
Oh no. It's kind of funny now, but probably not at the time.
I was just like, you know what? Shit happens. I'm out of here.
Oh, man. So So what's next for you? What's next for you the next couple of years?
You know, I'm kind of getting settled. I'm in 2 years. It was 2 years, April 1st, since he died. And I'm just now kind of getting settled into where I'm going to live and what I'm doing. And I'm just, once I get through a couple more months here of moving things around and changing, I'm really looking forward to pulling the book back out. Mm-hmm. What I'm doing right now is I helped organize a group. We're holding death cafes, and we're having a day long death symposium in the fall. And I'll be talking about death with dignity and also how to talk with people about dying, how to talk with your loved ones when they're dying. So I've done quite a few workshops either on the death with dignity or grieving or whatever. So I've been using that, the experience. And then now it feels like, okay, I finally can figure out what I want to. Oh, and you know what we're going to call the symposium?
What?
I came up with this name for our day-long symposium, Exit Strategies.
That's pretty good.
Because, and it was, there's some subtitle, something about how preparing for death enhances life or something like that. Because none of us is going to get out of here alive.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the little motto. So I'm really looking forward to that. I've been enjoying the death cafes. They're just, we provide coffee, tea, cake and cookies, and a place, and anybody can come, and there's no agenda. It's just people can sit around and talk about anything to do with death or dying or grieving. And I find it, and I was trying to think of a name for the group, the umbrella name, and I have to look up the statistics, but I don't know what the statistic is for the United States on how often somebody dies. Like, is it every 6 seconds or, you know, 5 a minute or something? But whatever that statistic is, that's going to be the name of the group.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, like 6 seconds or 5 minutes or whatever it is.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And then under that, we, you know, this group does death cafes, does this, does that, does something else.
Yeah. So if someone wants to invite you as a keynote speaker or invite you to their state to give a workshop, is that something that you would do?
I absolutely would. Yeah. absolutely would. I think broadly, I will be happy to talk about the death with dignity option, but I will always put in there that even if you don't have that option, the talking openly about death with someone who's facing death or is actively dying is just like a portal that opens up so many gifts and blessings and is transformative. So, yeah, I always kind of put all that in there. And then I've, I've done quite a few grieving workshops because we had one person who died. Her husband died unexpectedly, and she got really angry in her grief, and nobody knew what to do or how to approach it. So I did a series of workshops on how to support people in their grief, even when they're...
So how can people connect with you?
You know, right now, because I'm up on that mountain, just my email.
Your email. Okay.
I'm at JRJ5Acre. Okay. I have a website in the works, but I had to just take a step back, and then I have to get to where I have better internet.
Okay.
But that's coming.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Are we unofficial yet? Because I just want to ask you what's happening with your book.
Oh, okay.
Tell me when we're unofficial.
Yeah, we can be unofficial in a second. So, all right. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we wrap up here?
No, not until, is there anything? No, just thank everyone who's interested enough. I wish I had that statistic because I'm pretty sure it's everywhere and it's going to happen. And the more prepared we are, the more it can be an asset to life, something that, you know, just enhances life by facing it instead of, you know, doing this.
All right. Well, thank you, Juanita.
Oh, thank you, Carlina. We finally got to do this.